Hi, welcome to a special interview edition of Georgia Politics Podcast. I'm Joseph Chi of Monotonous.net and Doraville.org, and I'm joined by Randy Lewis of the Georgia Daily Digest and Georgia Political Digest. Today we're interviewing Melanie Ayer, Democratic candidate in the 46th State House District, which serves Roswell, Alpharetta, and Mountain Park. Thank you for joining us, Melanie.
Joseph, I'm glad to be here.
Welcome. First off, how did you choose to be a Democrat?
Funnily enough, when I first registered years ago in California, I registered as a Republican because everybody in my family was a Republican. And then over the years, I just realized that the ideals of the Democratic Party were closer to the ideals that I valued. And I'm what I call a North Fulton Democrat, which means that I take the best ideas that work from anybody who has them. And there are some positions I hold that are more on the Democratic side. There are some positions I hold that are more on the Republican side. There's probably a dash of Libertarian in there, too. But the reason that I am a Democrat is because I think the Democrats put the individual American or the individual Georgian first and realize that our economic strength is based on the efforts of that person. So to the extent that I think our efforts should be focused on supporting the individual American worker of whatever income range, that's why I call myself a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. And does that translate into individual freedom? I mean, up and down the political line of school vouchers and perhaps abortion and other issues like that?
Well, I mean, all those are different issues. In terms of abortion, I'm pro-choice. I mean, I don't think anybody will call themselves pro-abortion, but I am pro-choice because I think it is the woman's right to make that decision. When you get into the area of vouchers, vouchers is a word that just causes people to bristle. My position on vouchers is that I think our educational system in Georgia is in such troubled shape that I cannot take any option off the table to see what will fix it. My priority is education. Mm-hmm. And if there is a situation in which vouchers would work, then I would take a look at vouchers.
Well, if the school system is so troubled, why don't you give parents their money and let them go?
Because I think the first commitment of public education dollars is in public education. I mean, at the end of the day, we are a society that has put its educational focus in public education. We have for years, and it's going to stay there. And I think our job is to use the dollars first to fix public education. Let me give you another example. For example, I don't think public dollars should be spent on supporting faith-based education. If I'm a parent up in Roswell or up in Alpharetta, and my schools are otherwise performing, they're giving my kids a good education, I don't think that I should be given public dollars to put my kids in a faith-based school because that is a personal choice. If I am living someplace else and my school is not performing and my children are not getting a good education and there is no effort that we can make or have been able to make in the time my kids are at that school to fix it, then that might be an option. But I also don't think that public dollars need to be taken away from public schools to fund a voucher program. Because if vouchers are going to work, they have to be in competition with public schools, not instead of public schools. So I would not be in favor of diminishing public school funding to fund vouchers.
But doesn't the same principle work well at the higher ed level? I mean, don't we allow Hope scholarships to go to private colleges and universities? And don't we see that as a benefit for improving education in Georgia across the board? Why mm-hmm. wouldn't the same principle work at the public school level, say the K-12 level?
Because the system we have set up now, there simply are not enough enough private schools as there are public schools in there. I mean, our system is basically a private college system. And we also have a smaller population going to colleges than we do going to schools. So I don't really think you can draw that analogy. I think we have put our educational dollars in public education at the K-12 level. And I think that is, over the years, has been a system that has been wildly successful in fueling our economic success. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look back at other countries and other, for lack of a better term, civilizations, I mean, we are one of the few who has taken it as a mandate to educate every child and educate that child well. And we have done that by putting our money into public education. And even with the deficits that it faces, I think it has done a good job in doing that. Now it has new challenges and it has new deficits, but I don't think we need to give up on the system.
But what I heard when you first started talking was you became a Democrat because you supported individual rights and the individual's mm-hmm. ability to choose what's best for them. But at the same time, you're saying on the public school issue, children can only attend the school that the government assigns them to.
No. I think, let me back up.
That is, if they want to use their own tax dollars.
Right. Let me back up to what you think you heard. I became a Democrat because I think the emphasis of governmental support, and not necessarily monetary support, but policy support, needs to be to assist the individual Georgian or the individual American to succeed. One of the problems I see now is that the real income of Georgians and of Americans in general is falling as healthcare premiums rise, as energy costs rise. Corporate profits, which I know is another buzzword that makes people bristle on both sides of the aisle, seem to be rising, while the income of average Americans or the spending ability seems to be falling. To me, those are very problematic policy choices, because the reason I became a Democrat is that I think that we need to do a good job of supporting individual Americans. That, I mean, individual rights are obviously important. I'm on the board of the ACLU of Georgia. I completely support individual rights and civil liberties. But when I say support Americans and support Georgians, I mean come up with policy choices that enable us to have a secure retirement, to have a job that we know will be there, to have a good place to send our kids to school, to have clean water we can drink, the quality of life and the economic issues that support everyday people.
But and wouldn't everyday people send their children to school, and shouldn't they be able to choose? Let's suppose that there was a secular private school that did not involve religious training that
right.
they wanted to send their child to, and they felt that it was a better fit that met their child's individual needs. You're still saying they shouldn't be able to make that choice with their tax dollars.
If their public school is otherwise performing and meeting that child's expectations, then I don't think so. I don't think vouchers economically, and again, I have not made a thorough study of vouchers, so, and I always hesitate, you can see from all the stuff I've written, I always hesitate to give a thorough analysis of areas in which I have not made a thorough study, but I don't think that public education dollars and public dollars spent for private vouchers should be a 50-50 choice, because we have made a commitment to fund public education. And when you pay your tax dollars, that is where you think it's going to go. I think that vouchers, if we use them, should be an option that we should look at in troubled areas in which schools are simply not performing, and they have historically not performed. I don't want parents in those situations to be left without an option.
Okay. Well, I'm only starting with education
yeah.
because obviously on your website that's
oh, education is a huge
largest.
Issue for me.
Well, if we have all of these schools that are underperforming or that in Georgia you think the education system is deplorable, I mean, there's obviously going to be a price tag with that. How much more money do we need to put into public schools? They're already mm-hmm. consuming about 53% of the state budget. Obviously, on your tax bill that you get from your county, about 70% of the tax dollars that are collected on property taxes go to public schools.
They do.
I guess the question becomes, how much more? How much is it? $1 billion? Is it $2 billion? Is it $10 billion? And at what point do we say, you know, $20 billion or $50 billion isn't going to do the job? There's something else going on here other than money. I mean, what's the breaking point there?
I think you have to start out by figuring what your goal is and then working your way back. If the goal is to thoroughly and properly educate every Georgia child, you have to figure what resources you need to do that. I'm not sure we need a great deal more money at all. It may be an allocation issue. And we can get into this in a bit, but one of the things that upset me from the recent session was the 65% solution, which, if you read the memo of Education First that accompanied that plan nationally, they admit that the evidence that shows that dollars spent per student increases achievement is, I think the phrase they used was, decidedly mixed. So what they said is there's really no studies that show, or it's mixed, that dollars spent per student make a difference. You can look at some very low-performing districts, and you can see that their dollars spent per student are just astronomical. So obviously that equation is a false one. I think what we need to do is pay more attention to our educators and teachers about how to allocate dollars. What the legislature has just done is remove a great deal of that discretion and say that 65% of all operating funds have to go to what they define, and to be fair, it's what I think the NEA defines, as direct classroom expenditures. But in this session, the PTA was against it, the Georgia Association of Educators was against it. I'm not aware of any educators who came out for it, and they were completely disregarded in the legislature's attempt to advance what I regard as a political agenda. That is a long answer to a short question.
I'm not sure we need
to allocate or we need to increase taxes at all. We need to do a more responsive job of allocating. One of the areas we need to do a better job of allocating funds to is teacher training, which is not included in the 65% solution. I think studies do show that when the teachers are adequately motivated and trained and they're kept up on their training, like a lawyer is to go through CLE or a doctor has to go through CME, they do a better job and they're more excited about their job and the kids learn better. So no, it's not more billions. I just think we need to listen to our teachers and our educators about where to put the dollars.
But on the 65% solution, certainly it was a political tactic that's being used across the country right now. And certainly the Georgia Association of Educators and the PTA and all of those folks responded just as we all knew that they would. And in fact, what they did was supply evidence of what the Republicans have been complaining about for some time, and that is that educators seem to be resistant to virtually anything proposed that places accountability on them in some way. For example, educators were just fine with testing children and assigning them grades and determining whether they passed or failed each year until someone suggested that you use those same tests to determine whether or not the teacher is passing or failing. And then all of a sudden there's resistance to testing and then we're testing children too much and all of those things. I mean, at some point, do you sort of see the frustration that can come from the educrat opposition to virtually any proposal that looks like accountability on public schools?
Yeah, sure I can. What we need to do there is figure out a way that imposes accountability without imposing unfair accountability. One thing I've heard from teachers and educators as I've talked is we are accountable for student achievement, but for example, the test that evaluates that student achievement does not go along with the curriculum that we're required to teach. For example, the GPS is coming in, the Georgia Performance Standards are coming in. I hear from teachers that they have very little resemblance to the CRCT. So what do you teach? The CRCT is a multiple choice test which requires teaching certain things which may or may not be in the curriculum. So if your kid bombs the CRCT but does well on the curriculum, does that make you a bad teacher? Under the CRCT principles, I guess it does. But yes, I mean, if you have a teacher or an educators union or whoever comes in and says, I am resistant to change because it makes me accountable, I think any citizen would be frustrated. We need to figure out a way if our kids are learning right. One of my pet peeves about the CRCT is its standards are so below national norm. If you look at that study that came out by the Education Trust a couple months ago, it said that fourth graders who took the CRCT came out, 87% of them came out as beyond proficient. But actually that was elementary school students. But then if you look at fourth graders, only 24% of them who took the NAED, the National Assessment of Educational Development, came out at the same level. So there's a huge gap in Georgia performance standards and national performance standards. We need to close that gap. But in terms of teacher accountability, I don't have a problem with teachers being accountable, but I want them to be accountable over things they can control.
Last question on education. And how will you, as a Democrat in the legislature, how will you establish this accountability on education with... Obviously, the Democrats have long supported the NEA, the Georgia Association of Educators, and certainly the AFT, which is not as active here in Georgia. The PTA, all of those folks who are considered to be in the educratic blob. How will you establish some independence in holding them accountable and moving education forward in Georgia without being co-opted as a Democrat as they've co-opted Democrats for so long in the past?
I think that's a question that every individual legislator has to answer.
And how would you answer that?
Yeah. I think one of my strengths is that I am not a career politician. I've never run for office before. I mean, I'm going to go to the legislator and do what I think is right, whether it's deemed to be a Democratic principle or whether it makes the Democrats mad or the Republicans mad. At some point, I'll probably just about make everybody mad. The way you are not co-opted by the Democratic platform is that you continue to do what you think is correct. And in terms of accountability, let's look at some very troublesome statistics we have. In Georgia, about 40% of the kids who start high school end up not getting a diploma. If that number goes down, that means those teachers are doing a good job. That means more kids are staying in high school. I think the fact of the matter is the problems don't start in high school, they start in elementary school. Studies also show that if you're a good reader, by the time you're in third grade, you have a much higher chance of graduating. So part of me says that we should take Governor Perdue's completion counselors and stick them in third grade. They do a lot better good there. But if you look at statistics like that, the rate of high school dropouts going down, student achievement rates going up. One of the problems we have now, I think, is that we have too many standardized tests. Teachers take too much time teaching to the test and not teaching the subject. I mean, kids don't get excited learning particular items to take a test. When I talk to my son, who's 13 years old, about school, and I say, well, how is school? He says, it's boring. And every student I talk to says the same thing. We need to figure out a way to make it more exciting. And that's not, you know, like making it look like an AOL home screen. It's just engaging the kids' interest in the items they're learning. And I think our teachers can do that. How will I do that specifically? I think the answer is take a look at those tests and see if we really do need to be putting the emphasis on those multiple choice tests that we do. Find out other ways other states are holding teachers accountable or holding schools accountable. One thing I think we do need to do in Georgia is look at how things are going in other states and find out the successes they have. Listen to our teachers and educators about how they want to be held accountable. And if you get the sense they don't want to be held accountable, then you just figure out a way to do it anyway, but in a way that is fair and can hold them accountable for things they can control.
Okay. We'll give you a break on education.
Probably the way that I first became aware of your campaign was a lot of interest in the rather eloquent essay you wrote titled "A Manufactured Crisis" about all the discussion about a special session regarding the amendment on gay marriage. And I just wondered if you could maybe talk a little bit for the audience who's listening about what you said and about what this amendment kind of means to you and your campaign.
Well, I appreciate that opportunity. Back in 2004, we'll all remember the brouhaha about putting the gay marriage amendment on the ballot. And the gay marriage amendment had two parts, Part A and Part B. And I can't quote them verbatim, but Part A basically said marriage in Georgia will only be between a man and a woman, and it was very brief. And that was the part that appeared on the ballot. Part B was a great deal more expansive, and it talked about how no same-sex couple shall enjoy any of the benefits of marriage. And it also had a few other lines along the same line, but it didn't focus exactly on marriage. It talked about the benefits of marriage, of which there are many. Back in 2004, the sponsors of the bill were told by many people that it was likely unconstitutional because it violated Georgia's single subject requirement, which makes a ton of sense. I mean, we've had the requirement for a long time. It says that when you have a statute or a bill, it's got to be about one thing so that when you're voting for it, you know what you're voting for and you know what you are not voting for. That viewpoint did not carry the day, obviously, and the whole thing was put through as an amendment, even though only Part A got on the ballot. And so Judge Russell of the Fulton Superior Court was given the case before the November election, and she ruled that it was premature because it had not yet gone to a vote. That is one of the reasons I think that Judge Russell is not an activist judge, because if she were, she would have done something to moot the point then, but she did not. She just said, this is premature, it's got to go to a vote. So it did. And it was passed by over 70% of Georgians, and the American Civil Liberty Union and Lambda Legal immediately sued, along with some mm-hmm. named plaintiffs. Judge Russell has now ruled that it did violate the single subject requirement, which in my view, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but it plainly did. I think you can look at it and say that Part B certainly makes it a very rocky road for civil unions or domestic partnerships or any of the other contractual relationships that same-sex couples might have. And that's where we are. I gather the Georgia Supreme Court has decided to expedite the appeal. They're going to hear it on June 27th, and it's going to be on a webcast if we all want to watch it. Well, so,
yeah.
So in terms of the reason that I posted the column on my website is not that I think this is a central issue to the voters of North Fulton or even to the voters of Georgia, because it's not. One of my earlier columns was talking about the Georgia GOP's five questions to ask our gubernatorial candidates, the second one of which is, what do you think about gay marriage? And I said, along with Rusty Tanton's blog, I said, somebody has to explain to me why this is a major issue, because it really is not. In 2004, we got all these voters all excited and all hot under the collar about gay marriage. They all went out and voted against it. And you have to ask each of them, is your life better now because of it? Do your gas dollars go further? Do your energy premium dollars go further? How's your health care? Can you afford that now? Are your kids any better educated? The answer is no. It was a false issue then, and it is now. If we want to put another amendment on the ballot, we have plenty of time to do it next session. If the Georgia Supreme Court upholds Judge Russell, I understand that the governor is going to call a special session, and we're going to go through that whole enterprise again, which in my view is very disturbing, because it's going to divert Georgians from the real issues we have to face, which are much more problematic now than they were in 2004. Energy prices are higher. Our health care premiums are going much less far. These problems have not gone away. And by focusing the attention of the voters on that, it is diverting them from the issues that matter. I just wrote a blog on my website on Memorial Day about, this seems like an aside, but it's really not, about honoring our veterans. And I said the way we honor our veterans is by being the informed citizens that our system requires. I mean, we have to be participants in the system they died to protect. And the way we do that is by becoming informed on the issues, by educating ourselves on what's going on, and by making an intelligent vote. That is the best way to honor these people who gave their lives for us. And it's going to be more of a challenge to Georgia voters to do that in 2006 if that issue was on the ballot. From a personal perspective, I also wanted to write it because I've been in a same-sex relationship for 18 years. We have three kids that we adopted when they were 5 months, 2 years, and 3 years, and they're now teenagers. And to me, on a personal level, it is troublesome that my family doesn't have the same legal protections that other people's families do, especially since two of my kids are special needs and they need them. I personally don't care at this point if it's called marriage or civil unions or domestic, you know, whatever. I don't care what they call it. I would just like the legal benefits and protections that other kids get for my kids. And so that's where I come down on that issue, and that's what I said in that piece.
Yeah, one of the things that has always struck me as odd about this is that the government is basically defining people based on mm-hmm. how they engage in sexual activity. Is there a reason why we should not just allow any two people to form, let's call it a civil partnership that extends those same rights, regardless of whether or not they even live together, let alone have sex? I mean, or is there something critical about both heterosexual or homosexual people having sex that requires that the statute address them?
I think the question goes beyond sex. I think one of the problems in this is that people perhaps are focusing too much on that. In answer to your question, I think that it would not be appropriate to have any two people who may not be romantically linked, who may not have made a lifetime commitment, to enter into this sort of contract, because there is a value to cementing a legal bond between two people who have committed their lives to each other, who have decided to raise kids together and make a supportive and warm and loving home for those kids. That is quantitatively and qualitatively different from some people, from two people who just decide to form a contractual relationship for whatever reason. So I don't want to get rid of the model, because there is a benefit to it. If you look at the studies about kids raised in same-sex households, for lack of a better term, what I would call the reputable studies show that there is no difference in their development, in their educational level, in their self-esteem, in their ability to succeed as citizens of the world than kids raised in other households. There are other determinants, whether it's, for example, a household living in poverty, a single-family household. There are other determinants that may matter, but the sex of the parents is not one of them.
Well, one of the things that raised that issue recently was the University of Florida decided that it was going to extend benefits to same-sex couples. But it required that they essentially sign an oath saying that they engaged in sex. Obviously, then that what came back was, now we're going to ask all of the the heterosexual couples to now sign a statement swearing that they engage in sex. But it brought that whole element to
the
forefront.
Why did they do that?
I don't know.
Okay. I had not heard that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was just within about the last 60 days. I guess it comes back to the question is, what is the importance of the sexual relationship in either a marriage between a homosexual couple or a heterosexual couple that requires statutory oversight?
It's not the sex. It's the commitment. It's the fact that you have decided to live your life with this person in a permanent partnership and become a family and perhaps raise children in that family. It's not the fact that you have sex. There are people who get married who don't have sex.
My only other question was how the Democratic Party has supported you, since you have a long shot campaign, and most of the commentary I've read about it has been kind of skeptical. So I'm just wondering from you, how do you feel when you encounter that kind of reaction, and how has the state Democratic Party actually supported your campaign?
Because, I mean, I haven't really grown up in the party. I mean, I was practicing law, raising my family, and I decided to run for this office myself with the support of my family. And so, to be honest with you, I have not looked for a great deal of support from the state party, because I figure I'm up in North Fulton. The North Fulton Democrats is a very vibrant organization, and they are helping a great deal. They're going to help me go door to door. The woman who runs it, Ann Bartoletti, is just a complete powerhouse, and I know that I can get good resources from her. So I probably should go to the state party more than I am. When I have asked them for help, they have provided good input. I mean, it's still early in the campaign. Nobody's come to the point of giving money, or I don't believe I've asked them for money. But I don't have any complaints about how the state party is supporting me. By and large, they're very excited that I'm running. They're thrilled that a Democrat is running up in North Fulton, and they wish me the best of luck.
You're unchallenged in the primary, correct?
I am.
And let's sort of stay a little bit on that subject, but also talk about employment and employment security, which has been a big issue for you. The Democrats, either fairly or unfairly, have a reputation for being anti-business. And if somebody is thought to have made a windfall profit, then they're the first in line to want to put a tax on it. But yet in your own paper, I mean, you sound as if you are really big on entrepreneurial enhancements and mm-hmm. and getting jobs going and getting business going. That usually involves things like tax cuts or tax breaks for entrepreneurial businesses, things of that sort. As a Democrat, will you have problems supporting those kinds of things?
No. People may tell me not to, but I won't. I mean, people have to go to jobs in businesses. I mean, I'm an insurance defense lawyer. I represent businesses, and I know how businesses work, and businesses are the enterprises that give people jobs. We are not going to power up Georgia's future unless we can convince businesses to come here, make it attractive for them to come here, and make it very attractive for them to stay and grow here. And there are lots of things that require that. We have to have, for example, the technology infrastructure to permit that. We have to have the roads and the trains and the lines to permit that. I am not, it makes no sense to say if you are pro-job, you are anti-business. They don't go together.
Okay.
Well, we are at the end of our show. I wanted to give you maybe a minute to wrap up, Melanie, maybe direct listeners to your website and just say thank you for joining us. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you, Joseph, and thank you, Randy. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I would love your listeners to go to my website. It's www.melanieeyre.com, and I'm always posting things to it. I've got several position papers up there which contain, I think, useful information, and I would love the support and the input of your viewers. If any of them read anything up there and have a comment or a question or something they'd like me to address, I would love to do it. Please email me or call me. My cell phone number's on there, and I would love to hear from any of your viewers, and thanks for the opportunity for being here.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it.